Marilyn Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 25, delivered on November 19th.
Today, cash flow analysis. A few things to start with. Thursday, I will give you a surprise quiz. So that should be a surprise. Please act shocked. We have something called a Thanksgiving week break. So I suppose I'll let you not have class that week. And on Tuesday, when you come back, that's mainly review week. I'll cover a last bit of material from this chapter and others. And I'll also give you a final quiz on that day, on Tuesday. Thursday, all we do is review for the final, so prepare for that. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else major on the agenda. I don't think so. Seems like there was something else, but I can't remember what it was. But anyway, that kind of gives you a layout of what's going to happen as we come to the end of this very happy time we've had together as a family. Or something like that. Let's try a few things just to get started on this process here. Madam, good day or bad day on the street? A mixed day. Yes, it is. We have a little bit of down, just a fraction of a point down on the S&P 500. The Dow's taking a little bit more of a pummeling. But we got the NASDAQ up a little bit, and though that Russell 2000 is up. Maybe we can see a little more. Well, gold is certainly doing okay. So clearly there is some movement into the metals. And then the big one, the bonds, where are they? Oh, taking a little bit of a dip. So the price of that bond index is slid, which means that yields on the bonds are rising. That seems to be a more or less a trend, although there are up days, there seem to be more days down. And it's hard to tell. There's really nothing major going on right now. The markets are pretty much adrift at this point. Now, there are things in the news that will be coming up. Watch, after this semester is over, you'll be seeing more information coming in about sales for the Christmas holiday season, preliminary information, and that should make the markets dance a little bit, but still, it's probably going to be quiet going through the end of the year. Cash flow. I've gone through this several times, and sometimes I use the term free cash flow, and I'll probably continue to talk about this in terms of free cash flow. Giving you the clear impression, I hope, that cash flow is what we in finance are much more interested in than accounting profit. And just to go back through a little bit here, and I'm going to use a new term, and the book does not use this term, but it's a sort of a compact way of saying something. Look, earnings before interest and taxes times 1 minus the company's marginal tax rate plus adding back your depreciation and amortization, which isn't a cash flow, but we subtract it somewhere up the line before EBIT. Depreciation and amortization is subtracted out. And it's not a real cash flow, but it does affect your tax bill. So we have it up here allowing, and then we have to add those amounts back in down here. This is unlevered. I'm not considering right now any interest expense that's being paid. So keep that in mind. A term for this, slightly wrong. And this is something you would see in financial information. It's called NOPAT, net operating profit after taxes. It's a finance term, and you will see it, like in Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage. If you look at the numbers for a company, that massive sea of ratios and important numbers, you will see NOPAT shown there. You'll also see some of the other things that I've talked about, like weighted average cost of capital will be shown there too. But NOPAT is what money is there after we have finished all of the operating costs of the company, okay? And this, from this, we have to make all of the payments. Like, for example, and this is sort of a review. From this, we would, of course, first of all, have to pay interest expense. We'd have to pay interest expense. We would also have to pay any dividends that the company wanted to pay out of this NOPAT. And we would also, we would have to also pay for any changes in net working capital. So for example, okay, we've gotten all of our bills paid, and this is the cash we have left, this NOPAT. Okay, how about we up the inventory we've got on hand for the holiday season? Okay, for the months of October, November, and December, we're going to boost up $10,000 in inventory. Now, once it's over, we can, and as so, for example, in November and December, we start out, okay, well, let's do it in October, too. October, what we're going to do is we are going to change our inventory by $10,000. We're going to boost up how much we have in the warehouses. Okay, well, in October, we sell that $10,000 extra and some more, and then we are going to increase it back up to keep it at the level it was in October. That means the change in November is going to be zero because we are replacing what we already spent $10,000 on. Similarly, in November, we're going to sell that inventory and then replace it in the warehouse. So the change in December is going to be zero. Then in January, what's going to happen is, okay, the holiday season is over. Let's sell everything out of the inventory and get it off. So at that point, we will have negative $10,000. We'll bring it down to its pre-Christmas season level again. So along the way, you have an odd thing that happens with your cash flow, that what's going on with the NOPAT, what we use it for. We'll pull from the NOPAT that money that we've got for things to do. We're going to push up inventory by $10,000, and then we're just going to hold it at that higher level until the holiday season is over, and then we'll drain it back down by the $10,000. We'll just sell off that inventory, that extra inventory, back down to our pre-Christmas levels, and then we'll just move on from there. I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but I do want to point out that there is that going to go on here in this. I won't mention it right now, but it's kind of an important thing to consider. Well, actually, I do want to put it here. Change in net operating working capital. Okay. And then finally, we are going to get to the point where, okay, we have money left. Yeah. Okay, that can go towards our capital expenditures. Minus our capital expenditures. Now, this won't be enough to pay for all of our capital expenditures, but at least it gets us started on that road. We're going to use, this is that internally generated equity that I was talking about. A company will first use what it's got to pay for new projects, combined with debt
to keep its debt equity ratio
at the optimal. And then when we go through this, then we go out and sell new stock to mix with debt to keep our capital structure right where it was. And I'll go through this a couple of times. On Thursday, I'll give you an example. I'll just go walk through an example. We'll do it in Excel, which is a lot easier, I guess. Okay, anyway. So at the end of the day, free cash flow would be this mess minus your capital expenditures minus plus your change in net working capital, net operating working capital. I keep doing that. Net operating working capital. Now here I'm assuming there are no dividends and no interest. In other words, it's an unleveraged firm that doesn't pay dividends. When I say unleveraged, that means it has no debt in its capital structure. This simplifies it a little bit for us to start off with. This is a lot like work. Now, don't sweat this stuff. I mean, if you're really into finance, I do this again in 242, 341. Probably I'll do it again in 349, our last course, just to reinforce it over and over again. But anyway, before I go there, capital expenditures. They come in two flavors. Capital expenditures. The first kind are new. Something we haven't done before, something that is out there. It's not part of what we do from day to day. And then there are the ones that are replacement expenditures. Now, we would do a replacement expenditure to, for example, to make a fleet of trucks more fuel efficient. We get rid of the old ones and we buy new ones. That saves us money. And so that saving of money becomes the incremental cash flow. Let's say that we had an old fleet of trucks, and they cost us $50,000 a month in operating cost. Now we buy this new fleet of trucks, and they cost us $42,000 a month in operating expenses. That means that the free cash flow up there at the revenue line, that's $8,000. That's how much we've saved by going to this replacement. The same would be true, sir. You're now getting to that age where you're really not very productive. We pay you $125,000 a year. And are we getting our money's worth? We can hire this young woman. She is not going to fuss if we pay her $90,000 a year. And of course, we'll have you train her, and then we won't tell you she's replacing you. We'll have you train her, and then we'll fire your ass. And we will save $35,000. She's a new project, and she brings literally to the table a positive incremental free cash flow of $35,000. Prepare for that. It will happen, and you will be sad. Probably it will be replacing all of you, and this is something that's going on now, and it will go very much more aggressively in the next 5 years, 5 to 10 years. Replacing people with college educations in technical and fields like yours with artificial intelligence systems, which will cost a lot less than you will. So as we replace you with AI, we will have positive free cash flow from this replacement project. You are nothing but a machine, and you are outdated, antiquated, and rather inefficient in terms of your expense and all the things like health care we have to do for you, vacations, sick days. The machines will do a lot more efficiently. Welcome to capitalism. This is real, and it's already happening dramatically. It's not being talked about much in the news, but if you hear the stories, it's just amazing how much human capital is being replaced right now. But that's your problem. Eventually, they'll replace me with a machine, too, but it will be so much less fun. Okay, so now, do understand that there are actually nuances in here, too. Another thing that I want to bring up here, in free cash flow, if you're doing this and you want to be really, really accurate about it, or think you are being really accurate about it, you will do like quarterly free cash flow projections, monthly free cash flow projections. Hell, you could even do weekly free cash flow. That's actually not, the book says, well, it's inefficient. It's actually also silly, because trying to project at that micro level for almost any normal project is just going to be counting angels on the head of a pin. You're going to be lucky if you're within 10, 15, 20% of the actual of what actually happens when you project even at the yearly level. And it gets worse the farther out you go, because your confidence level goes down dramatically. But anyway, I'm not going to take this too far, this example, but just to illustrate something, the year and the free cash flow. We might have $50,000 coming out of the grinder to pay for this project in year zero. Okay? Then we're going to have year one. It will take off pretty sadly with $8,000. Year two with another $12,000. Year three, another, let's say it starts doing pretty well, $20,000. Year four, it holds pretty firm at $20,000. And then it drops off in year five to, $6,000. And then there's a salvage value. A salvage value, like I said, it can be positive or negative. But take this into account on the salvage value. You would want to make sure that you included tax effects, tax consequences. So basically, the tax on salvage value, and this is nothing amazing. All you do is take the tax rate times the salvage value minus the book value. The book value is going to be how much is left of that capital equipment on your books from the accumulated depreciation. Book is, and I'll just write it down here, book is going to be initial cost less accumulated depreciation. God, I'm starting to have my hands shake because I'm writing accounting. Now, there's an alternative here. Some companies actually analyze and do like a year six, seven, however long it takes to just burn it down to the book value of zero. They just let it fizzle out. So you have these odd tailing years, as we call them, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, to let the project just kind of go to its final, you've depreciated the whole thing off your books. An example of that, I may have mentioned it already, is when we were doing, when this partnership I was in, we were doing low-income housing for the elderly. I mean, these projects would not last that long. I mean, really. 10 years would be the feasible economic life before we'd have to put something else up and move all the people there from where we were. But these damn things had 20-year depreciable lives, according to FASB. And so you'd have 10 years of depreciation tail out here. And we'd say, well, are we going to just hold on to the property and just let it die? Well, no, what we'd do is we would simply, you know, cash out. We'd just sell the thing to whoever wanted it. So we'd still have this, you know, we'd sell it for, let's say, I don't know, maybe about $400,000, but the book on it was still, we'd sell for $400,000, but the book would still be like $250,000 on it, for heaven's sakes. And so we'd have this $150,000 that we'd be exposed to in taxes on the property. So there was that that was going on. But anyway, always remember your salvage value, positive or negative. Now, shutdown costs should be part of that last year. How much is it going to cost to end this thing? We're going to have to, as I've said before, and I'll just say it again, you're going to have, maybe you'll sell it at a profit, you'll sell the equipment, and you'll be, after taxes, you'll have some money. That would be a positive number there. But you're also probably going to have things like, you're going to have to get rid of some of your employees or repurpose them or something like that. You're also going to have to pay for things like environmental remediation, getting the place safe and clean so that you don't get fined by the EPA. Or another thing is, well, I could sell this with the environmental problems still intact to someone else, but they're going to want a real great bargain if they have to clean it up instead of us. So one way or the other, you're going to face costs, and those you consider against how much you're going to make off selling it. The alternative that I told you, and just make sure that this is in your notes, it is not the worst idea in the world, if you can, to see if you can make some of that stuff charitable donations. Just give it to others. I just ran into this. It was this semester. It kind of amazed me because this company had a lab where they were doing quality assurance testing. And what they did, they would have to have remediated the lab, you know, because there was computer stuff in there and there were all kinds of possible hazardous chemicals, I don't know. But what they did instead was they gave it as a donation to a local college. They said, here's a lab. It's not too far from your campus. Do with that whatever you want. If you want to get rid of the equipment in there and put new equipment in, you can. But we've got some pretty not that old testing equipment, all the electronics testing stuff. So they donated it, and they got a tax write-off for that. So that for them, that was great. The college wasn't quite so smart because they thought this was an awesome thing, but what they actually did was accept a donation of a future salvage liability because they got it as is, so it becomes their problem whenever they, down the road someday, want to get rid of it. So it was sort of a sneaking way to get a problem off your shoulders. It would be sort of like, I've got this great son, madam, and I'll tell you what. Look, I know you want a child, so here's my son. Well, it turns out he's demon seed. Yeah, okay. It's true. It's true. And so, you know, you think, wow, he gave me a whole kid. I can eat it, I can sell it, you know, or I could, you know, put it to work in the field. But the problem is that at night, you know, he invokes Beelzebub and, you know, you have all those demons coming in and eating at your fine oak woodwork and munching in the refrigerator.
on raw steaks that you bought that you were planning to give, cook for a family reunion. You know, it's a mixed bag. Where the hell was I? Okay. Anyway. Unlike inventory, this stupid thing, this $50,000 up front, you don't recover that. It's not recoverable. See, I erased it. With that inventory thing, your net operating working capital went up, so free cash flow goes down. And then at the end, your net operating working capital goes down, so your free cash flow goes up. It's not a wash because of the present value issue, the discounted value. However, there's sort of like a balance there. With that $50,000, that is a sunk cost, or at least some of it is. You're not going to get that $50,000 back. Don't consider that, well, at the end, we'll get it back. No, you won't. Whatever you get back at the end, if there is positive salvage value after taxes, that's gravy. It actually has nothing to do. Well, you've got to consider, no, once we put that $50,000 in, that is gone forever. It has gone home to Jesus, and you're never going to see it again. Well, at least I won't, because I'll be going to the other place. Okay? So you've got to consider that $50,000 is not recoverable. Once you put it in, don't ever think about getting it back. This is true in investments. Well, I'm going to hold on to this until I get my money back from where I put it. No, you're not going to do that. If you actually make a profit off that investment, wonderful. That was gravy. And the same thing is true here. That $50,000 is all gone. A mother's work is never done. Another thing along the way here. Those numbers that I wrote there for the free cash flow stream over the life of the project 5 years, that's that over there. That is a product of that over there. That NOPAT, minus, etc. When you look at this in the larger context, you look at companies and you will see sometimes that they are profitable in the accounting sense. But when you look at the free cash flow, it is staggeringly, mind-numbingly negative. And that's why you will sometimes see companies that are not, that look profitable, actually, their stock price drops after they post earnings. The odd other side of that is sometimes you'll see a company that will have a negative profit, in other words, a loss, and the stock price will go up. An example of that happened late last week, with JCPenney. It posted a loss. The company is clearly still in serious trouble. It lost money. But if you look at the free cash flow, it's crawling out from the disaster that happened in the collapse of the big box of the big retailers like Sears, JCPenney, and others. On the other hand, you'll look at other ones like Kohl's. It's looking very bad on a free cash flow line. Another one, Tesla. Right now, oh my God, thank God its free cash flow was slightly positive. Okay, look a little more closely. How did it get a positive free cash flow? Because it just borrowed a massive amount more money. So, yeah, we got a positive free cash flow there, but the question is, how long is that sustainable? There are only so many years that baked pothead can keep suckers coming into his harebrained investments before the bottom has to drop out or something else. Another one. Xerox tendered a bid for HP. HP rejected the bid. Let me show you real quick. And again, as I've done through this course, I'm trying to show you that
numbers are wonderful. We have to do them. But if you can't apply it to real life, it's just, why are you doing it? Okay, let me call up, see if I can do Xerox here. Xerox. Ooh, they took a tumble today. Wow. Well, they were doing a little bit. But let me look at the five. Let me look at the 1 month. Well, gee. Right here, see this? This would have been where HP rejected the Xerox bid. Right in this area right here. Well, as a matter of fact, it jumped. Today, it's taking a bath. But why would it have jumped after it got rejected in a bid for another company? What would be the market's logic? What would be the market's logic? Madam, it got rejected, and yet the price didn't show a rejection. You don't know? Okay. You're on Tinder, and you get rejected.
It's no.
Yeah, right. I have a button. No, I don't even have a yes button. No. Anyway, okay. But everyone says, "Bruh." Whacks you on the back, slaps you on the butt, you did good. Why? Well, because the target was going to hurt the company in the assessment of the markets. So when it didn't happen, that was good news. When you didn't match, that was actually good news for your future because the potential match had turned out to be a serial killer and an arsonist. So you get axed and then you get cremated. On the bright side, that saves funeral expense, yes. But you understand what's going on here is that actually sometimes what looks like negative news on the... if they'd taken HP, revenues would have gone up. Oh, but they would have also been taking on a burden that would have bled free cash flow. So when it didn't happen, the market said, it's all good. Things are normal now. You have to think in terms of what is this, what's the implication on free cash flow? Let me show you Netflix here really quick, just so that I can beat up that poor company one more time before this is over. NFLX. Okay, let's look at this thing out 5 years. It put a bunch of, it got a huge amount of money in. And yet, that over $4 billion along the way, right in this area, well, that's an awful, awful lot of money that adds to the company's war chest. And yet, with all of that extra money in the company is showing, the market is showing that it's not particularly impressed by these giant wads of cash coming in. Why? Because the company is just making itself riskier and riskier. And as risk goes up, the discount rate for future expected cash flows is going to go down. Let me say that again. You write that in your notes because I'm going to find a way to ask you. When risk goes up, the discount rate on free cash flows goes up with it. And therefore, the present value of those free cash flows goes down. When risk goes up, the discount rate for free cash flows goes up with it. And therefore, the present value of those free cash flows goes down. So whether or not it actually affected the free cash flows themselves, that extra money, What it did affect, and in a negative way, was the present value of those free cash flows against what the investments were that they were trying to use those funds for. So the free cash flows might stay clean, but if the discount rate for those free cash flows out there into the future goes up, that actually causes the value of the projects to go down, the net present value of those projects to go down. And that's one of the worst things that's... Whenever I keep showing you this, I keep harping and farting on this right here. Look. I keep saying, well, bonds went down today. Our bond prices went up today. Well, that means that or something like that. I'm keying on what that means about interest rates, but what is really I am keying on is what that means about the present value of future expected cash flows. So I see the 10-year bond index. It's showing a tendency to sag on price, which means it is showing a tendency to have yields rising in the economy. That means that the present value of future expected cash flows across the economy becomes lower. That is the hallmark of the pre-recession. So even you, madam, you're a project. I hire you in my company, right? I expect you to bring in positive free cash flow. You're an incremental project. So I figure that you'll probably bring in a couple hundred thousand. So I'm going to pay you well. I'm going to pay you $30,000 a year. So I'll get an extra $170,000. And I will work you for the next 50 years. You know, you'll be like 70, no, let's say 60 years, 80 years old. Yeah, welcome to Walmart. Welcome to Almart. Almart. Welcome to Almart. Well, you're 80 years old. Okay? Well, you see, the problem is that, yeah, that's the present value of that is certainly more than what I, my initial investment, a little bit of training and maybe, I don't know what else, but the problem, though, is that as interest rates go up, the present value of those future expected cash flows in you goes down. Therefore, there is a higher probability that I will not hire you. I will hire something else, especially something else that is not as sensitive to the cash flow is not as sensitive to interest rates. Okay, I've gone through that. This is sort of like a grab bag of issues before the Excel spreadsheet. And this is, again, a classic example. You can open all the Excel spreadsheets in the world. You can use the fanciest computers and all of that. You can pass the CFA and things like that. But if you can't answer and think about fundamental questions and issues and the larger economy in which we operate, you got nothing. And I brought this up before, and I just want to, what I'm about to say here. And I'll just bring it up one more time, the idea of your revenue projections. Just about everything you do to project your NOPAT is going to be driven by your revenue projections. Because even though it technically you might want to do it by other means, a lot of times all we do is take, okay, we are going to assume that our cost of goods sold is this percentage of revenues. So you give me the revenues, I got my cost of goods sold. We assume that sales, general, and administrative expenses is a certain percentage of revenues. So once you know your revenue projections, you've got your selling, general, and administrative expenses projected. So these revenues are right there at the top of the list of things you don't want to get wrong. Even though doing this is pure crystal ball, just a crystal ball. Let's try this. I
don't know. Who haven't I bothered here? You, sir. Project your revenue, your how much you're going to make in 2025. Go ahead, project it for me. Call it.
Based on what?
Are you trying to be intelligent on me? It's a good question. Yeah, but you see, I want it now. I'm the CFO, and if you do not give me this projection, I am going to put you back down in the mailroom. You do not want to be in the mailroom because we're getting a lot of Amazon packages every day, and you have to carry them upstairs. I'm talking about heavy exercise equipment for our new exercise room. I'm talking about a new latte maker for our latte room. It's an upscale company. Come on. Okay, here's the point. It is actually not, it is part art. It's, we throw it up and see if anyone salutes it, kind of thing. And that's one of the problems with revenue projections, especially if the project is something that is new. A replacement project is actually easier to forecast the incremental revenue, which is an incremental saving. We would already know what these new trucks, for example, would have in fuel use and maintenance. And then we could compare that to what our current trucks have in fuel use and maintenance. So that we could do a lot more easily than when we have a new project straight out of the box, especially the more this project is different from anything that's ever happened before. There was a... I actually have one last prototype in my office from many years ago. I can never remember where whether I've told stories to the class or not, but it was back in the 1980s. This was when computers were first starting to show up in home use. IBM had these kind of like big boxy things, and there were Compaq was in the mix there. And as we were getting towards the later 1980s, there was more concern about, well, how close to a monitor should you sit? Because we knew the phenomenon was happening in offices of people leaning in and craning at monitors like this, and we knew it wasn't going to be good for their eyes. So there was an optometrist who developed this set of little clip-on half glasses people who wore bifocals could use, and when you set them on, it made you sit back from the computer so that you could focus correctly at a safe distance, at a healthy distance. The project was called Screen Eyes, and I've got one last little package, one of them in its little pouchy in my office from the prototype testing period, if you ever want to see it. But the thing was, how in the hell do you project revenues on it? First of all, it would have to be sold through optometry offices. So we'd have to have a point of purchase display with these little pouches there, pull it out. Ooh, these fit right on my glass. Oh my God. All that. Okay, how many optometrists are going to let us do that? What are they going to want as a cut on the product? What do we even charge? There's, as I've said before, there's no god of pricing. Do we charge $10, $20? In Taiwan, at John Lee Manufacturing, they were running us 83 cents a pop. That included the actual physical object, a little leather pouch, red, kind of gaudy, and then a little package that they went in called, a little box called Screen Eyes. They would even throw in pop displays, point of purchase displays that we could put them on. But still, what do you charge for these? Well, obviously you charge what the market can bear. How did we know what the market could bear? Well, we talked to focus groups. Focus groups suck. They don't tell you anything. Okay, so you see, getting just right out of the right out of the box, this is a tough thing to do, projecting the revenues. How in the hell do you do it? Well, you do what you can. You use a lot of marketing terminology, and you say some things like time series analysis and quantitative analytics, and maybe you'll get people to leave you alone with your projections. Okay, that's one part of it. And then, as I mentioned, you also have to recognize cannibalization. And you also have to recognize synergistics. In other words, is this going to hurt revenue from another project? Well, that has to take down the incremental cash flow. Do you have a product that this is going to impact in a negative way? Okay. How about, do you have any products that this will help in a positive way? Will this, if this project is really good, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. I'm talking and spelling at the same time. Let me try that one more time. That looked more like synagogue. Synergies. There. Happy now? Geez, I got my own spell checker right here. Cool. Where was I? Is this going to boost your sales? So, for example, sometimes a company that has kind of a lower reputation, once it starts to make a move into better products, once in a while, those can actually up the entire brand or improve the entire company's reputation. Oftentimes, bringing new products online actually benefits a company far beyond that product. Companies like Hewlett-Packard were selling highly defective computers, Omnibooks and Pavilions, that were tanking out very badly, and there were furious customers because HP took to the old routine was something you did. And then finally, over a long period of time, once the anger at that had calmed down, HP came back around with a larger set of products. Its printers, which had always been strong, it brought back in a good way. It came out with HP paper, bright colored packaging on bricks of paper, all kinds of other things, which then rehabilitated the company's reputation. So sometimes new products can rehabilitate a company's reputation, and sometimes they can simply up the entire level of a company's reputation. The truth be told is that some of the restaurants that you go to now, restaurant chains, they were at one time more downscale. And as they have taken on new projects, they have rehabilitated the reputation of that brand name. And so now it's much more respectable and more people will go to it. Another thing that has to be taken in here, this is coming actually in the cost side. These are special considerations for this lecture. One thing on the cost side, don't ever forget, is opportunity costs. Remember that opportunity costs are the costs of the best foregone alternatives. They are very real. And they oftentimes dominate the entire cost schema of projects. It's not what money goes out of your pocket. It's what money does not come in some cases. What did you do with this machine? Well, we put it into this project. Why didn't you put a cost there for it? Well, because we already own it. No, no, no. It is a cost of this project. What was the best other thing you could have done with it? Well, we could have sold it. Well, there you go. There's its cost to you. What could you... Well, we're using this land. Well, so we don't include the cost of the land because we already own it. Well, what else could you have done? Well, we could have sold it or we could have leased it out. Okay, find out which one of those would have been the best present value for the use of the land. That's the cost of that land. Again, with people in a company, if you retask a company employee, that company employee becomes a cost of the new project you're sending that employee to. Sooner or later, it will come back to you as a real cost.
This is the same thing in economics. A lot of times we see things that in a way don't make sense until you include the opportunity cost of the time. Why, for example, do we see people standing in stupidly long lines at places like Disney World to ride a ride that's going to make them vomit? Oh, I see. That's because these people don't make a lot of money, so the opportunity cost of their time is extremely low. Why do we see some of these silly, talentless bands have streaming lines waiting for dozens of hours to get a ticket to their concerts? Oh, because these appeal to people, young people, teenagers, even pre-teenagers, who have very low opportunity cost of their time. Why do we have video gaming having such an enormous surge now? Oh, it's because the kids who do that don't have a lot of other things to do with their time. They don't make money enough for it to be a cost to them to sit in front of a game for hours and hours at a time. That's getting to be a serious, serious issue. Oh, this is popular because, and it will get worse when people get poor in a recession. These kinds of things actually go up in value. Revenues from those kinds of gaming platforms and the games themselves go up because people don't have a high value for their time anymore. Opportunity cost is there. Another one, and I am really appreciative that the book brings this one up, environmental cost. Those aren't just at the end with remediation. They are ongoing, and they are, in quite a few cases, rather appalling. Well, we're just this company. We do services. Yes, you also have environmental issues involved in these companies from day to day. You also have changing regulations, and then you have to get in front of those and know what's going to happen, or you get blindsided. You always have... Most corporations of any reputation, even small corporations, have what they call legislative liaisons so that they can warn the company of changes that are coming in worker safety, in liability exposures, in environmental regulations. These things have to be taken into account. They are real, but they used to be forgotten. More and more now, companies are recognizing these can end a project if we don't watch them. These costs can. And some companies that are very large have indeed faced nearly being destroyed by regulations that changed on them on the fly, and they didn't think those regulations applied to them because they had already started the project. Turns out they did, and the companies nearly lost their existence to them. So those kinds of issues are in there too. And as I mentioned, there's also the court rulings. Court rulings can massively change the way a corporation deals with issues. Classic example, companies, even in my time, companies didn't take things like sexual harassment seriously. It took the courts to ding companies to the extent of hundreds of millions of dollars before we suddenly realized, okay, we have got to bring in these kinds of people, this kind of training, these kinds of procedures and protocols to deal with the issue. Those are costs that are new to the company. So in other words, we bring in a compliance officer. We've never had one before. That's a project. Well, that's just a cost to the company. Actually, no, that's a revenue to the company. You ask yourself, what would happen if we didn't have this person? And then how much less will we lose if we have this person? Suddenly it becomes a positive net present value project bringing this person in. Also, public relations. PR. I can tell you a lot of projects that would really work, but the public relations backlash would be problematic. Sometimes you bring online a project and you don't even think about what the impact is going to be on public relations. Or you do something. What's going to be the impact of this on PR? Okay, we brought in those disgusting veggie burgers. Have any of you had one? The meatless burgers? Okay, good. Because, okay, I'm not going to say anything about it. But yes, I am. They're terrible. But, okay, you see, they really don't give that much of a rat's ass about whether you eat meat or veggies. What they do care about is getting a PR boost. So, if we bring in a veggie burger, that gets us in the news. It gets us seen. It gets people excited about us. And that means that people come in, they buy other things there. You take your kids there, no, mommy, I don't want that veggie burger. It's got GMOs in it. I don't want Frankenburger. Shut up. It's got Roundup in it, too. It'll help you grow. Pests won't bother you. What's the public relations? Sometimes, on the other hand, negative PR is what you want. It ups your reputation. There was a rather famous, if entirely talentless, singer that in 2013, was it? He got on stage and disrespected a very talented young woman who was on the stage. He just trashed her right there. He was a jerk and a disgusting misogynist for doing it, but his sales of his albums went through the roof for doing it. He took on a project that had a positive net present value because it was a dirty public relations disaster. But that got him noticed, and that got him supposedly famous. Consider the PR. Is this going to have an impact on us as a company? Is it going to be bad, or is it going to be good? If it's bad, is it bad bad, or is it bad good? You know what I mean. Anyway, taking all of that together and coming back to here, and we'll have a salvage value on this project of, and I here on this after on the salvage value, go back in your notes and write after tax. Be sure you do that, and then refer to that right there. Okay. I forgot to connect those two up. There's a chain there. Okay. So after taxes, let's say your salvage value is $500. And as I've said before, you just put that on your terminal, or it might end up being 1 year past the terminal. Might be 1 year past the terminal. But I'm going to say it all happened in this final year. And let me say one real quick thing about that, is that companies, some, have a tendency to not plan well for the end. There's so much excitement about the road itself that they don't have the map of what happens at the end laid out in detail. And if you've got a project that's like, say, 10 years, it goes 10 years, well, you're leaving a big problem for the people who are there in the company at 10 years, 20 years. And this was one of the things that happened with a lot of these environmental disasters, environmental waste pits. It's companies were, well, they knew someday they'd close these projects. They knew darn well that there would be an environmental problem at the end. But they didn't have a roadmap that was that so that along the way they were planning for this finale here. And so when the people who were told, okay, it's time to close down the project, went to look for the plans, okay, how do we do this close down? What are the engineering schematics? What are the markets? What are the regulations? They had nothing. Well, what are we supposed to do? And so the project sort of pissed along in this dead stage for too long. Someday, madam, I will die. I don't plan to finish it up really quickly. I plan to linger 5, 10 years, complaining, using medicines, having tubes put in me. yelling at, you will be the assistant. Woman, bring me some coffee. Not too strong. My kidneys, they're gone. You see, that's the thing, though, is in companies, we can't let this thing flop along. So always remember, plan for the end at the beginning. Get it done now. Now, there'll probably be some unforeseens, like what the environmental regulations will be and all that. But plan for the end at the beginning. And there's going to be reasons for that. For example, going back to environmental waste. Okay, well, we didn't plan for the end of this project, so along the way, we were just dumping this crap of ours into this waste reservoir out on the 40 acres behind the factory. And then at the end, oh, God, instead of along the way, okay, this month we're going to have this much waste. We dig an environmentally sound containment pit for it, and then we move on so that at the end, those containment pits have already taken care of the problem. So in other words, planning for the end has a lot to do with the planning and the costs that come along the way. Instead of just shoving those costs off to here and not even thinking about what they actually are in detail, well, there you go. So, okay, anyway, all of that aside, it all boils down to getting the free cash flow numbers and taking the net present value of the future expected cash flows compared to the upfront initial cost. It's just NPV. At this point, after all the Excel spreadsheets and the fancy, awesome, wow, that's a big spreadsheet. You must be intelligent, which is kind of a big thing these days. The bigger and more complicated you make the spreadsheet, the more believable it seems to be. But anyway, you get it down to here, just take the NPV, and it says yes or no. It boils down to that. And almost every product that you see on the market is this right here. It happened in something like this. And I will show you on Thursday. I'll go through a couple in quick detail. One has to do with a company that made a gluten-free breakfast pastry. And then I'll show you also one that was one of the pioneers in routers for the Internet of Things. But that's all I have for you today. I thank you.